C3 Radio aus dem Zentrum für internationale Entwicklung.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, to the OSCE Development Lecture number 19 on the topic of global water scarcity and the need for a sustainable approach to water management.
So hat OFSE-Direktor Werner Ratzer zur 19. OFSE Development Lecture begrüßt, die am 23. Juni 2021 als Online-Veranstaltung stattgefunden hat. In der heutigen Ausgabe von C3 Radio berichten wir darüber. Willkommen bei C3 Radio, sagt Jürgen Planck. Der Hintergrund zum Thema. Angetrieben durch die Klimakrise entwickelt sich Wasserknappheit zu einem globalen Problem. Besonders betroffen sind die Bevölkerungen in den Ländern des globalen Südens. Das Management der Wasserverfügbarkeit wird durch potenziell konkurrierende Nutzungen erschwert, zum Beispiel Nahrungsmittelproduktion, Energieerzeugung und andere wirtschaftliche und soziale Aktivitäten. Wie lassen sich diese Herausforderungen nachhaltig bewältigen? Gemeinsam mit Professor Steven Gorelick aus Stanford hat die OFSE einen innovativen Ansatz zur Einbindung betroffener lokaler Stakeholder im Projekt FUSE erforscht, das unter anderem in Jordanien und Indien tätig war. Die Abkürzung FUSE steht für Food Water Energy for Urban Sustainable Environments. Damit zum Keynote-Speech von Steven Gorelick. OFSE-Forscherin Karin Kübelböck, die ebenfalls bei FUSE dabei war, hat die Lecture moderiert.
Professor Gorelick is one of the world leading experts in freshwater management and he focuses also on long-term impacts and long-term policies for securing water supply. He has carried out policy-oriented research in different regions such as India, Vietnam, Jordan, Mexico or California, where he is professor in the School of Earth, Energy and Environmental Sciences and is a senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University. Professor Gorelick runs the Hydro Program and directs the Global Freshwater Initiative. He has authored several books and published over 150 papers, including in Science and Nature. He is a member of the US National Academy of Engineering and a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Yeah, we have been working together in the FUSE project since 2018, which Professor Gorelick will also talk about in his keynotes.
So just on the global water fact situation, less than 0.3% of the world's water is usable for people and irrigated agriculture. And you should note that irrigated agriculture is only 20% of cultivated agricultural land. So there's a lot of potential for more irrigation, even if irrigation gets more efficient. World water use has increased at twice the rate of global population growth, and one in six people lack access to safe water.
Man kann nicht sagen, wann die Nutzung von Wasser nachhaltig, nur wann sie nicht nachhaltig ist, führt Gorelick aus.
Unsustainable means that it's basically a bathtub type aquifer or a lake where, or some kind of system where it's a finite amount of water and that water is being used and it's being depleted. It could be soils that are becoming salinated and they're not going to be useful anymore. Vulnerability, on the other hand, has to a certain threshold of well-being that you want to maintain, but seasonally or otherwise, you can find that there's a drought and well-being suffers, but that then can recover. But that suffering period is something you want to avoid as a society. And then you have chronic scarcity where even if the level of resources is increasing, you know, it may not go straight up, but it's increasing, you never reach a level that is an acceptable level of human well-being.
Gorelick zeigt anhand einer Weltkarte, dass es viele Regionen mit Wassermangel gibt.
A lot of the U.S. is in terrible deficit now. You'll read about it in the newspapers to come, and it's really, really the worst situation they've had in California since reservoirs were built. Northern Africa, we work in the Middle East. India has this issue. I've spent about a year, half of my life in Australia, where this is a big problem. And even in South Asia and in Southern Asia, there are areas that are having this difficulty.
Dann berichtet Steven Gorelick von Chennai in Indien, wo für 7 Jahre geforscht wurde. In der Region gibt es Monsunregen und in die Forschungszeit fielen das trockenste und das niederschlagreichste Jahr der Geschichte. Die Stadt Chennai hat rund 7 Millionen Einwohnerinnen und liegt an der Küste des südindischen Bundesstaates Tamil Nadu.
And I should point out that India doesn't have any major city with a 24/7 water supply system.
Wie wird Chennai mit Wasser versorgt?
So they get 77% of their water from these reservoirs, so they have surface water reservoirs and they have some well fields. And then there's tanker trucks. Back then, there was only 2% of the public utility had access to tanker trucks that fed mostly the slum areas. And everybody else was reliant on standpipes or having water that was provided to them through some other pipe network system, but intermittent. And then the rest was groundwater. And you can see that there's 420,000 wells back then in this region. Now, to put that in perspective, if you have a European football field, you would find 7 wells in that area. So there was wells everywhere. Why would people have so many wells? Because the supply system is so intermittent that anybody who could afford a well would have a well because you wanted to have access to water. And so this was their insurance policy.
In trockenen Phasen versorgen private Tanklaster insbesondere die Slumgebiete der Stadt mit Wasser. Rund ein Viertel der Wasserversorgung funktioniert mittels Tanklastern und eigenen Brunnen. Der Pro-Kopf-Verbrauch pro Tag liegt in Chennai bei rund 100 Litern. Zum Vergleich, in Wien werden 130 Liter verbraucht. Oft wird in Chennai Wasser in Kanistern bis zu den Häusern getragen. Wie viel kostet Wasser für diejenigen, die über Wasserleitungen bis zum Haus verfügen?
Pipe water supply was about 5 cents per kiloliter. You know, if you have a household of 3 or 4 people at 100 liters per capita, then, you know, there's a couple of days of water supply for this much water.
In Bezug auf Wasserleitungen spricht Stephen Gorelick ein weiteres Problem an.
In India, the pipe leaks are in this region about 25%, and there's an effort to maybe reduce those, but getting it, you know, to half of that would be a challenge.
Das Schließen von Lecks in Wasserleitungen könnte die Wasserversorgung von Chennai verbessern, ebenso die Nutzung von Regenwasser.
This transitional solution, it's not a permanent solution, is rainwater harvesting. And what we found was you can raise the tariffs on the rich people, on the people who use the water and can afford to have their tariffs raised. You can fix the pipe network, meaning you reduce the leaks from 25 to 12%, and you go with groundwater harvesting for non-potable uses. And what we found when we did a cost-benefit analysis is the costs are such and the benefits are such that this is a win situation. And so it was a valuable thing to get you through some number of years.
Welche Zusammenhänge gibt es zwischen der Wasserversorgung und einer weiter fortschreitenden Urbanisierung in der Region?
Okay, so we look at one index of vulnerability, and that index is the percent of the population receiving less than 40 liters per capita per day during a drought. And what we see is that this vulnerability index is that under the circumstances that they were in, a lot of people, like 75% of the peri-urban and 65% of the city itself, is in this situation where they get 40 liters per capita per day, which is a very low number. Then as this urbanization occurs, 99% get 40 liters per capita per day. And so what we were predicting was that basically no one would get pipe supply beyond about 40 liters per capita per day. And here's what happened. It happened sooner than we thought. This happened in 2019. And here's the pictures of the reservoir that's full in 18. In 18, it starts to decline. It gets pretty full. And then it starts to decline through 2019. And it goes completely dry. And this other river goes completely dry. Actually, what we predicted happened. It just happened a little sooner because population growth happened a little sooner than what we said.
Welchen Zugang zu Daten gab es im Rahmen der Forschung in Chennai?
We had access to household surveys of water use before and then and after, or, you know, during this period. And so we had really good data. So in the remaining few minutes, I just want to talk about our FUSE project. Werner was kind enough to mention is that this stands for Food, Water, Energy for Urban Sustainable Environments. We are dealing with the Food, Water, Energy Nexus, and it consists of Stanford as the lead organization and coordinator. But OFSI has been really instrumental in developing our stakeholder engagement. And I'll mention what we did in that way. And then we have the Helmholtz Center, UFC in Germany, and the ENYASA in Austria as partners for this collaborative group. And we've been working for about 3 years now together on this. We are a collection of hydrologists, people who know about agriculture, energy, modelers, people who do stakeholder engagement, urban sociologists, economists, and people who do integration of all these different fields. And so that's our team. And we're working in two areas. One is Pune, which is a wetter area of India. We were formerly over here, now we're over here. And then we have this other area, which we're working at, is in Jordan, and we're focused on Amman. I'll just mention that there are similarities. They have limited access to water. There are intermittent supply systems. They have decaying infrastructure, and they compete for water and energy in a sectoral basis between food, energy, and water. Difference is in climate change impacts are much greater in Jordan than they are in India. India will get maybe even wetter, but it'll have great variability. Jordan just has twice as many droughts of twice the duration. And they have intermittency differences. They have a different socioeconomic structure. India's a lot less well off than Jordan. They have political economy differences. Sugar is grown in India, and they have different governance systems. So we're working in both of those two areas. And our process is that we have this stakeholder engagement effort, which was run by ASSI and was incredibly successful. I was taken by it. It was really quite amazing. And then we're developing this policy evaluation model. We finished one for Jordan. It took about 25 person years to develop the model. So a lot of people contributed to this model, and we're in the midst of that right now for India. And then we're going to India as soon as we can get past COVID, which will probably be not even this calendar year. Okay, so what happened in the stakeholder engagement is we're trying to get ideas about future challenges and from the stakeholders, and then we have experts providing solutions. So let's see how that worked. We had a fabulous set of workshops in India, in Pune, and Karen spent about 2 months in Pune figuring out who should come to these workshops and who shouldn't come, and really vetting all of the people who could contribute and having a great distribution. There was a stakeholder analysis, and all that was done. Really excellent. And so we have these different groups that were incredibly engaged, incredibly appreciative of what we were trying to get from them, which is what their challenges were. They had various exercises to get them to think about their current challenges and how they're dealing with them, and then what their future challenges are going to be like, and to scare them a little, saying, you're going to have climate change, you're going to have prices go up, you're going to have less resources, what are you going to do? We then did that in India, we did that in Jordan. You know, the stakeholders were NGOs, were farmers, were people from industry, from people from civil society. And this is the group that we had in Jordan. And then we have experts, and the experts came in and say, okay, we have these challenges. What are the solutions? Those people were former government officials, including a former minister of water. We had former secretary general. We had consultants. We had academics in Jordan, at least. In India, we have less communication with the federal government, but it's really a state-controlled system. So we have some communication with the state government. Okay, so that's that. And then we had the experts, and they come in and give you these solutions. The challenges are for food, water, energy. We have this triangle, and we have urbanization. We're focused on Pune, India, which is a city. Both cities are, you know, roughly the same size, Pune and Jordan and Amman. And so in terms of individual aspects of this nexus, we have concern with power outages, concern with solar grid integration, not receiving water, not receiving money for energy. We have insufficient metering for water. Water is stolen or leaks, and we have degradation of soils. So this is just examples of the kinds of challenges that we found. And then you have ones that are more centered around the city, urban sprawl, affordability in slum areas, water quality and competition for water. And then things at the interfaces between food and energy. You have undependable supply. You have nutrient leaching, which then affects water quality, and you have dam silting, which makes the energy possibilities from reservoirs less. And then potential interventions. I won't have time to go through this, but I'll give you just an idea of what they are. We have governance, supply, demand, the sugar sector, irrigation, and energy policy. And so under governance, you have existing of regulations. That's pretty pervasive in places we've seen, that they have laws on the books, but they don't enforce them. You have local solutions for rainwater harvesting. They want to know how they can implement that. What would the effect be? And can you reduce non-revenue water, meaning water lost or stolen? There's price supports for sugar. Sugar is a big industry in India, and it supplies jobs. So people don't want to see it go, but it has some negative impacts on society there because it's producing sugar and their diet is laden with sugar. Adoption of new irrigation technology and biofuel and solar PV are things that we're looking at. So all of these are different interventions that we can do, things that they can do in the face of climate change and socioeconomic growth for which we have scenarios. So we consider moderate climate change, RCP 4.5 and 8.5 as the more severe climate change, And then we use the SSPs to look at socioeconomic growth, where we have a fast growth and a slow growth scenario. So right now we're developing the model, and we're going to go to India and we're going to Jordan in September to get stakeholder responses and evaluate our model results. So the insights we're getting from this workshop so far is we've had very good co-creation with the stakeholders. In other words, they have told us what their challenges are and what their potential solutions are. Many of these we've thought up ourselves, but we didn't know their priorities, and we also didn't think of everything that they think of or what, you know, they thought was most important. They have limited capacity to assess policy solutions and interventions. They might suggest things in a particular domain in water, food, or energy, but that could have negative impacts on the rest of the other aspects of the nexus. They're eager for this approach. They really got behind that we were trying to help them, that they were the first people telling us how to guide their system, and we weren't being dictatorial or in any way providing information to them recommendations that we felt strongly about. We give them lots of choices. So the government has a very short-term approach and limited ability to think about sustainability. In the places that we've been working, they think about water provision on weeks and months, and they just can't really get through like long, long-term decadal timeframes when climate change and population growth is really going to kick in. Amman is pretty different than Pune. Amman has civil society trusts the government to act, so they relinquish their power to the civil society, to the government, and that seems to be the way they function. In Pune, it's really different. The civil society is very proactive and pushes the government to act. So with that, I will sign off, and I'm interested to hear what the others have to say about how this in any way relates to what's going on there. Thank you.
Sagt Stephen Gorelick. Wolfgang Gruber arbeitet in seinem Kommentar heraus, dass die Wasserversorgung in Wien zur Gänze von der Stadt organisiert wird. Im Unterschied zu Chennai gibt es hier kaum Lecks und bekanntlich kommen rund 95% des in Wien verbrauchten Wassers aus den Bergen, aus geschützten Gebieten. Der Rest ist Grundwasser. Es gibt in Wien 31 Wasserreservoirs, die im Falle einer Notsituation die Wasserversorgung jedenfalls für 4 Tage sicherstellen. Wolfgang Gruber.
Also, of course, we are always monitoring the water quality, which comes from spring water and also, of course, from groundwater. The groundwater wells in a great extent are inside Vienna, but they are in the national park of the Vienna floodplains of the Danube. So this is also a protected area, but of course, it's a mixture of groundwater and Riverbank Filtration Water.
So Wolfgang Gruber von der Magistratsabteilung 31, die in Wien für die Wasserversorgung zuständig ist. Moderatorin Karin Kübelböck leitet zu Theresa Schütz von der ADA über, die in ihrem Kommentar Wasserversorgung und Genderfragen in Afrika miteinander verknüpft.
Water has been one priority sector of the Austrian Development Cooperation for many years. ADA supports partner countries in setting up sustainable water supply and sanitation facilities and strengthening responsible institutions, and has also focused on the food, water, energy nexus, so very timely and suitable to today's topic. I'm very happy to introduce Theresa Schütz to you. She's water and sanitation advisor at the Austrian Development Agency, mainly responsible for the portfolio in sub-Saharan Africa, Uganda, Mozambique, and regional programs.
The second program that I wanted to showcase is called Water Climate and Development Program Gender. I wanted to showcase this program in particular because it's a good example on how to think beyond the sectors and beyond technical solutions, to highlight kind of the need to think of also about social aspects, which we water people like to forget most of the time. It's because if drivers of vulnerability, such as gender inequality or inequitable access to natural resources, is not taken into account, we may create interventions that reinforce or redistribute or create new vulnerabilities. And that's what we're trying to avoid, obviously. So the program, which is implemented by the Global Water Partnership, is a 5-year regional gender marker 2 intervention in sub-Saharan Africa, which is piloted in 5 countries and aims to promote a gender transformative planning, decision making, and also institutional development for climate resilient water investments in Africa. So it's combining all the topics: it's climate, it's gender, and it's water. The program has just started. However, their comprehensive gender analysis for each of the countries were already conducted. And I want to highlight a few main takeaways from these analyses that are quite relevant also when you look at it from a Nexus perspective. So the first one is that gender inequalities exist in access to and control of natural productive resources, such as land, water, and energy, that are necessary for water security and climate resilience. There's a low level of understanding and appreciation on how men and women are differently impacted by and respond to climate change. In most cases, there's also inequalities in decision-making positions. So political representation at all different kinds of levels are dominated by men. And there were also gaps identified in terms of inadequate stakeholder platforms to facilitate dialogue. So this also relates back to what we've heard before, especially with integrated water resources management, the stakeholder participation is a really important process. And we need to also think about how can we promote gender equality in that aspect? How can we promote climate resilience? So by addressing these gaps, the program is basically trying to mobilize political commitment for this gender transformative action to kind of remove systematic barriers. And there will also be small local demonstration projects to kind of showcase how this can be implemented. So with these two examples, I kind of want to conclude my commentary, and I thank you very much for the attention.
Moderatorin Karin Kübelböck leitet drei Fragen aus dem Chat an Stephen Gorelick weiter.
Population growth versus reservoir capacity. Where is the extracted water ultimately ending up? Is it not that humans ultimately bring the water back into the system?
You know, we did a whole analysis of cities all around the world, and we looked at cities that get their water from distant areas and saw their vulnerability to that. So it's true that you don't necessarily have water where you need it and you go elsewhere to get it. And so that's one solution that some cities have found. But by and large, most of these places that we've been working, the water is fairly local. They do have interstate compacts where they're supposed to get water when they demand it from another region. But they, during a drought, all bets are off and they really don't get that water. So yes, they are bringing water, I guess, back into the system. I'm not sure what that means, but it's from a distant area. And that is a solution if it were to be abided by.
Why has water use so much increased in agriculture? Is it mainly population growth or changing and more water intensive production methods?
You know, population growth has driven agriculture for years. And if you go back and you look at the early part of the last century, the percent that went to agriculture was enormous. And it's just a direct function of income and how of GDP, national GDP, that under or developing nations use a lot of water. Right now, I think I read that India's like 90% of the water is going to agriculture. It's just they're a very strong stake politically all over in every place. And to get water out of their hands is subsidized. Water is really cheap for industry. In the US, we pay 10 times what agriculture pays. So they have a very strong foothold on water. And it's just viewed as a necessary obligation we have to farmers right now.
Why is desalination so environmentally damaging? Can better technology help?
That's a great question. It has been environmentally damaging because it takes a lot of energy to desal water, and it's just really expensive. But there is the possibility, especially in Jordan, where you can desal using solar. And so there's actually been experiments with both pumping, but I imagine you could do them with solar as well, letting farmers, for example, generate solar power and then use that for agriculture. But you could do that for desal as well. And that would bring the price down as photovoltaics come into play and they become cheaper, which they have been enormously, then desal can be effective. The problem is that environmentally, you have to get rid of the saline water, and that saline water is dense and it sinks to the bottom of the ocean where there's benthic organisms and it can destroy fish habitat. In the case of Jordan, you have the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea is declining on the shorelines coming in by 1 meter per year. But if you did Red Sea DSC desal, you take that brine and shoot it down below sea level to the Dead Sea. And that has environmental consequences. So there's a lot of people who think you shouldn't do that because the Dead Sea has a unique species that live in this highly saline water and they don't want to upset that.
Sagt Stephen Gorelick von der Stanford University, Er war der Keynote Speaker der 19. OFSE Development Lecture, von der wir in dieser Ausgabe von C3 Radio berichtet haben. Gorelick hat zum folgenden Thema gesprochen: Global Water Scarcity and the Need for a Sustainable Approach to Water Management. Kommentare dazu haben Wolfgang Gruber von der MA31, die in Wien für Wasser zuständig ist, und Theresa Schütz von der Austrian Development Agency, kurz ADA, abgegeben. Abschließende Hinweise: Auf dem OFSE YouTube-Kanal findet man auch ein Video zur Development Lecture von Kari Polanyi-Levit. In früheren Ausgaben von C3 Radio haben wir über Fuse und über die Development Lectures berichtet. Nachzuhören auf c3radio.potspot.de bzw. www.zentrum3.at. Dort findet man Informationen zu allen Veranstaltungen und Angeboten im C3, etwa zur C3-Bibliothek. C3 Radio gibt es wieder in einem Monat. Auf Wiederhören sagt Jürgen Planck. C3 Radio aus dem Zentrum für internationale Entwicklung. Mit den Organisationen Baobab, Frauensolidarität, Mattersburger Kreis, OFSE und Paulo Freire Zentrum. Weitere Informationen und Podcast auf www.zentrum3.at.